fortunate we are to have found objects, reliable objects, to take refuge in. That we've been able to find a meaningful direction to take in our life instead of wandering around doing who knows what, motivated by any impulsive emotion that enters our mind. So instead of that, we've been able to find the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, have confidence in them based on knowing what they are and trusting them, and thus cultivating a relationship with them, like a sick person who goes to the doctor to be cured. So we're the sick person, the Buddha's the doctor, the Dharma's the medicine, the Sangha are the nurses. So let's not waste this fortunate opportunity. And let's also realize that if any other karma had ripened in this life, we could have been born in a totally different situation with no ability to meet the three jewels. And we would have been influenced by whatever environment we were born into. So with a sense of compassion for people born into difficult situations, then let's use our opportunity that we have for this very short time to do something useful for ourselves and for them. In particular, planting the seeds of the Dharma in our mind, and maybe even gaining some realizations. In any case, progressing on the path to full awakening, so that we can increase our ability to be of greater benefit to living beings. Recognizing that there's not a big difference between us and them. I was thinking as I said that last little bit, there's not a big difference between us and them. With presidential debates and all the things that these candidates are saying, they're making very big differences between us and them over things that, are not significant, And really reinforcing this feeling, there's an us and we have to protect ourselves from them. And them is, of course, anybody who looks different or thinks different than we do. And so when we come across people like that, then we tend to feel with them, like there's us and then these nuthouses, nutcases. Don't we? It's like there's me and my friends, and then there's Trump, Ben Carson, and they want to register all the Muslims and make sure we only have Christian immigrants. And I mean, we're not like them. And then here we go. We're creating in us and them just like they are, aren't we? And forgetting that, just different karma ripening, and then we could have been born in their situations or been born thinking like them. And it's we are thinking like them and creating us and them, aren't we? Yeah. So there's nothing to be kind of haughty or arrogant about, is there? No, it's really working on our mind and having some compassion for people who are just like us, crazy, just like us. Yeah? And, you know, we have this opportunity now, so to use it and then, you know, think to be able to benefit them in the future. Be nice, you know, in this life. Go to Congress, go to the White House and give a Dharma talk. Yeah, I'm not holding my breath for that opportunity. So maybe future lives, you know, being able to meet these people and, yeah, plant the seeds of Dharma in Ted Cruz's mind. Yeah, there's some work to do, isn't there? So, but it has to start with us working on ourselves, not with calling other people names. Although, what's the phrase we learned?
See how they are.
See how they are.
Yeah. Where did you learn that?
At the dentist.
We learn important things at the dentist.
I'm glad you're sharing it.
Okay, so last week we talked about the qualities of the Buddha. Now we're going to go on to the qualities of the Dharma and the qualities of the Sangha. Okay, so when we know the qualities of the Buddha, like we went through last time, yeah, and we've been through before the four fearlessnesses, the 10 powers, the 18 unshared aspects, we went through the different kinds of enlightened activity. Then we ask, well, how did the Buddhas attain these qualities? And the answer is through the Dharma. So that's the characteristic of the Dharma. Okay, it's especially the true paths when you follow, when you actualize those, we actualize those true paths in our mind. Then they have the power to directly destroy ignorance. Okay, they're like medicine that cures a fever. And then through, you know, taking that medicine of the true paths, we arrive at the true cessations, which are the cessations once and for all of the afflictions and different defilements. And so that's like taking medicine to keep something from recurring, except in the case of the defilements, once you've eliminated them, they're gone forever. Okay, at this, you know, when we've attained, when, after the path of seeing. Okay. So, yeah, so the true cessations and true paths are the real refuge that we need to practice and actualize in our own mind. And they are explained in the 12 categories of scriptures, which is sometimes abbreviated to 9 categories of scriptures, which are symbolized by Yamantaka's 9 heads. You're a Jinchen practitioner. Then with the qualities of the Sangha, then when we know the qualities of the Dharma, then we are automatically understanding some of the qualities of the Sangha, because they are people who strive to actualize the Dharma and have actualized and integrated certain aspects of the Dharma in their minds. For example, you know, in the 37 harmonies to awakening. Okay? So the Sangha, by hearing and contemplating and meditating, the three kinds of wisdom that come through those three activities, then they always practice and they create merit. They teach others. They are fair and compassionate. then are in the process of eradicating their afflictions once and for all. So they're on their way to Buddhahood, and they're good examples for us to follow. And when we have doubts and questions, we can go to them and ask. So in terms of the hearer arhats, the Shravaka, those who follow the Shravaka or hearer vehicle, there's many types of hearers, yeah? The ones that, remember I was saying before, is taught in the Pali tradition, those who gain their realizations based on serenity, which is excess concentration, are called the dry wizened arhats. But the ones who have deep states of samadhi have actualized different super knowledge, the different super knowledges. And so, for example, they can make their body manifest into many bodies, and many bodies manifest into one. They can appear, they can disappear, they can, this is all done through the power of concentrating on the elements. They can fly, they can miraculously go places where their students are, or where their teachers are. And they have many methods to benefit sentient beings. So sometimes we look at like the hearer arhats and say, oh, but you know, they're just hearer arhats, they're not bodhisattvas. They can benefit plenty of beings, and they have more compassion than we do. So there's, again, nothing for us to get uppity about. Okay, so especially when you think of disciples like Shariputra and Moggallana, yeah, Shariputra's the one who is best in wisdom, and Moggallana in these different super knowledges. So they had, great abilities and, very subdued, to the extent that people even looked at them walking and said, I want to ordain and be their disciple, just because the way they walk through space indicated something about their mind. Then the solitary realizer arhats, they have more good qualities than the hearers because they've collected merit for longer time than the hearers have. So there's two kinds of solitary realizers. The first ones live communally, and they live at the time when there's a wheel-turning Buddha. And then there's the other ones that are, they say, are like rhinoceroses, because they live alone during a time when a wheel-turning Buddha has not appeared. So they live at that time, they practice the Dharma, they attain liberation, through the teachings that they had heard before that lifetime. And they teach, but they usually teach through gestures. Okay. And then, of course, we have the Bodhisattva Aryas. So, the Bodhisattva Aryas start from the path of seeing on up. The Bodhisattvas on path of accumulation and path of preparation are ordinary beings. Yeah, they may have an inferential realization of emptiness, but it's not a direct realization. On path of seeing, they have that direct realization. And that's when, according to the Prasangika, they start the process of eliminating the defilements. So on the path of seeing, they eliminate the acquired defilements, acquired afflictions, that ones they learn in this life. And then the beginning on the path of meditation, they eliminate the innate afflictions. And when they attain the fifth bodhisattva path, the path of no more learning, then they're Buddhas. So within the path of seeing and the path of meditation, you have the 10 bhumis, or 10 grounds. And each of the grounds specializes in one of the perfections. And then each of them also there's a set of 12 qualities that each of them have, but how many of each of these 12 qualities they have increases as they go through the bhumis. So on the first bhumi, the first ground, they can behold 100 Buddhas. They can receive inspiration from all 100 of the Buddhas. They can live for 100 eons. They can see for 100 eons in the past and in the future. They can enter and arise from 100 samadhis or concentrations. They can vibrate 100 world systems and illuminate 100 world systems with their radiance. They can make 100 sentient beings ripe for, or mature for, realizations and go to 100 pure lands of Buddhas. They can open 100 doors of the Dharma through giving teachings to sentient beings and emanate into 100 bodies, and each of them is surrounded by 100 bodhisattvas. Okay, and then, so that's on the first ground. On the second ground, then instead of 100 of all of these 12 things, it's 1,000. On the third ground, 100,000. In the fourth ground, 1,000,000,000. And then so on. The numbers become higher and higher. Okay. So the Arya Bodhisattvas are said to outshine the hearer and solitary realizer practitioners in two ways. Okay. So one is on the first ground, and the second is on the seventh ground. Okay. So on the first ground, they outshine the hearers and solitary realizers through their lineage, in the sense that because in addition to having the wisdom directly perceiving emptiness, they also have the practice of the special method that's supported by bodhicitta. So they're in the lineage, the bodhisattva lineage, to become Buddhas. So in that way, they supersede the hearers and solitary realizers. So the example is given, like a monarch's child. Okay, so this is, you know, old time. Yeah, although I wonder about dynasties in the U.S., the White House too. Anyway, okay, so from the moment a monarch's child is born, that child has a higher status than all the ministers, even though the ministers are more learned and more advanced, because that child is the child of the monarch, okay, and they're of royal lineage, and so they're served, they're honored, you know, more than the ministers. So in the same way, these first ground bodhisattvas are of the Tathagata lineage, and they're on their way to become fully awakened Buddhas. And so, you know, in that way, they supersede the hearers and solitary realizers. So even the hearer and solitary realizer arhats, who have attained liberation, they supersede them, you know, because they are closer to full awakening than those arhats. Because remember, those arhats have to go back and start the bodhisattva path from the beginning and accumulate merit, whereas these first ground bodhisattvas are already on the path of seeing. Then the second way, or second time, they outshine the hearers and solitary realizer arhats is on the seventh ground, okay? And this time it's through the power of their wisdom. Before it was the power of their lineage that was supported by bodhicitta, this time the power of their wisdom, okay? And that's because they can enter into and arise from meditation on emptiness in each brief instant. So this is extremely difficult to do, because in meditative equipoise, the mind and the object emptiness are undifferentiated. They're like water mixed with water. Yeah. So they can go back and forth between that kind of deep realization of emptiness and seeing conventional objects as illusion-like very quickly. And if you think about that, that's got to be really difficult to do because they're, you know, one's totally, your mind's totally merged with emptiness. The other is the completely opposite kind of mind, seeing the illusion-like conventional truths. Okay, so they can do this very quickly. And so in that sense, again, they're like the monarch's child. As the child now is getting the royal education and is a young person, you know, they have these special abilities. Okay, so being close to the monarch, having the special education, then they outshine the ministers. So again, yeah, the bodhis, the seventh ground bodhisattvas outshine. They hear in solitary, realize they're arhats. Okay, then by the eighth ground, they achieve 10 powers, says Chandrakirti in his supplement. And so they have power over their lifespan, power over their mind, and that they can enter and emerge from limitless types of samadhis. Power over the necessities of life, so they could find all their requisites. Power over activities, so they know all the different subjects, you know, fields of knowledge, and can teach these. Power over birth, so they can be born wherever they wish, as whoever they wish. Power over prayers, to manifest in any form that's needed. Power of fervent regard, because they can manifest anywhere that they see fit. Power over miraculous powers of emanations, because they can go to any pure land they want to make offerings and accumulate merit, or to listen to teachings. They have power over exalted wisdom, which is unimpeded, and power over the Dharma, in that they understand all the words and meanings of the Dharma. So the eighth bhumi, the eighth ground bodhisattvas, they are out of samsara, so they're officially arhats, you know, and have eliminated all the afflictive obscurations. So they also get these specific 10 powers. Quite amazing. Okay, so that's something about the powers of the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then when we know those and we think about them, then we see that there's reason to trust them. Yeah, when you think of the qualities of the bodhisattvas, yeah, they're trustworthy. You know, they can guide me.
When they, you know, they talk about the child of the Buddha a lot, and you hear it in Shantideva a lot, is he always referring to highly realized bodhisattvas, or is it sometimes used in a more general way?
Sometimes the term child of the Buddha is, it's used in a general way for bodhisattvas, but, you know, they really become of the Tathagata lineage at the first ground. Mm. So, but, you know, that's often the term just means bodhisattvas. Okay. So now there's a different section, which is a new section, which is taking refuge by knowing the distinguishing features of the three jewels. Okay. So here somebody might say, well, you know, the three jewels, each of the three jewels has so many good qualities, so is it sufficient to take refuge in only one? You know, because they have so many good qualities. And the answer is no, we need to take refuge in all three, because there's differences between them in how we relate to them and, you know, their characteristics and all. So we're going to go through, it has 6 ways in which, you know, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are different from each other, necessitating taking refuge in all three. So the first is they're different in terms of their characteristics. So here, the Buddha's the one who has abandoned all defects and developed all good qualities. So the Buddha has the complete abandonment and the complete realization. Okay? They can see the two truths simultaneously. They're omniscient. Yeah, so that's the characteristics of the Buddha. The Dharma, the characteristics of the true path and true cessation. So what the Buddha taught that actually meets the needs of sentient beings. And teaching the Dharma is the reason why the Buddha appeared in our world. Then the characteristics of the Sangha are those who realize the Dharma and give us and guide us so that we can do the same. So they prove the validity and usefulness of everything the Buddha taught, because they've actualized, or, you know, the major parts of it, or are in the process of, you know, going up the paths and grounds. Okay? So when you see the differences between the characteristics of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in this way, then you see why we have to take refuge in all three. Yeah, that refuge in just one of them isn't complete. Okay, is that coming through? Yeah. It's good, you know, to spend some time contemplating this in your meditation, because then it becomes a little bit clearer. You know, their different functions. Okay, then the second way that we can differentiate them is in terms of their awakening influence, or trinle. Okay, so the Buddha gives the transmitted and, you know, the transmitted Dharma that leads to gaining the realizational Dharma. So the Buddha, you know, his awakening activity is to tell us what to practice and what to abandon, and to transmit the Dharma in the ways that are most effective for sentient beings. Okay. The Dharma's enlightening or awakening influence is that it eliminates the afflictions and suffering. And then the Sangha's enlightening influence encourages us and gives us inspiration and assistance in practicing the Dharma. And they're our companions, so we know that we're not alone on the path. Okay. So again, we can see there's some difference here according to their awakening influence, how we relate to the three jewels. And so, you know, for that reason, we need to take refuge in all three. Then the third one, third term in how they're different, is their the aspiration or fervent regard that we have for each one of them. Okay, so with the Buddha, the way we relate is we aspire to make offerings. We have respect. We rely on them with a, you know, an attitude of humility and devotion. We have a sense of gratitude for their kindness, and we want to offer, you know, not just material things, but to offer service and offer our practice to them. So that's the kind of fervent regard or, you know, aspiration that we have for the Buddhas. In terms of the Dharma, yeah, what we aspire to do is to put it into practice and to and transforming our minds into the Dharma is how we show our fervent regard for the Dharma. So how do we show our respect for the Dharma? By transforming our mind into the Dharma. And then in terms of the Sangha, yeah, we have aspirations, or we show our fervent regard for them by practicing together with them, and by joining them in their efforts to make Dharma a living force, to spread the Dharma in the world, preserve the Dharma in the world, create peace in a chaotic world. You know, we join together, and we all do this together. Okay, so that's the aspiration or fervent regard. Then the fourth one is how we practice in terms of each of them. Okay, so with each of these, I'm going through them, but I'm not making examples. In your meditation, go through and make examples. Yeah, and that will help you understand it. Okay, so how we practice in terms of each of them. So the Buddha is the model for what we want to become. The Buddha is our role model. So, how do we practice in terms of the Buddha? Bowing, making offerings, respecting them, asking them to teach, asking them to not pass away. Okay, so we really use the Buddha as a field of merit because of the Buddha's great realizations. Then any virtuous action we do with respect to the Buddha, becomes very powerful. So we try and create a lot of merit with the Buddha as an object so that we can become like the Buddha. Yeah. So this doesn't mean, looking at the Buddha with some kind of business mind, like, I want to create the most merit possible, and the Buddha's the way to do it, so let's forget about all these sentient beings and just focus on the Buddha. No, it doesn't mean that. Yeah, because obviously what the Buddha cares about more than himself is sentient beings. And it's the welfare of sentient beings that forced the Buddha to, motivated the Buddha to go through all the paths and grounds to full awakening. Okay? So we respect and honor the Buddha for that, but that doesn't mean we ignore sentient beings. Yeah, with this mind that says, I want to attain the most merit, and the Buddha's the best way to do it, so forget sentient beings. Yeah, you getting what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because a lot of people have that kind of attitude. I want to give to the highest object to create the most merit. Yeah, without really thinking. Yeah, well, who does the Buddha cherish the most? And if I give, all sorts of huge offerings to the Buddha, but I treat sentient beings horribly, is that pleasing to the Buddha? Is that making a good offering to the Buddha? People often forget to look at things that way, but I think it's important. Okay, then how we practice in terms of the Dharma, we meditate on it. We integrate it with our body, speech, and mind. We, practice it in our daily life. Okay, and then how do we practice in terms of the Sangha? We practice together with them. We share the teachings, we share material possessions with them, and again, we follow their example. Okay, so the Sangha is really, our good friends on the path that we can rely on, who have genuine wisdom and aren't going to lead us astray by giving us worldly advice. Okay? And then the fifth one is what qualities to remember, what to be mindful of regarding the three jewels. Okay, so with the Buddha, to be to be mindful that the Buddha has eliminated ignorance, anger, and attachment, has developed all wisdom to the highest degree, has similar with compassion and all the realizations on the method side. Okay, so, and the Buddha's fully omniscient and leads us to awakening. So when we think of the Buddha, these are the kind of things we want to remember or be mindful of. You know, and not like, why does the Buddha have long earlobes? I mean, it's a good thing to know, but that's not what you want to spend your time when you're thinking about the Buddha. You know, why does he have those long ears? Why do they make the statues like that? You know, I'll tell you the answer because I know you're so curious. It's because it illustrates that he was once a prince, and of course the royalty wore big pieces of jewelry, so much so that the earrings stretched his ears long, and that's why he has long earlobes that have a hole in the middle, because the earrings stretch them. So if that makes you think of, you know, the Buddha's renunciation and what he gave up to benefit sentient beings and practice the path, then that's good. That's a nice thing to remember when you're mindful of the Buddha. But, you know, the mindfulness means kind of, I think you got the point. Okay, then with the Dharma, to be mindful, or to remember that it brings good results in the beginning, the middle, and the end. So last night, remember, we were talking about the Dharma, the importance of having a Dharma motivation in the beginning of an action, the middle, and the conclusion of the action. So this is along the same line, yeah, to act with the Dharma in our heart when we start something, in the middle, and at the end. And then with the qualities to remember in terms of the Sangha is that they're on the right path. Yeah, they're impartial, so they are true friends to us and true objects of respect. And they give us, companionship and friendship and encouragement on the path. So that's a nice quality to remember when we think of the Sangha. And then the sixth one is in terms of the merit, how we create merit in terms of them. So the Buddha, we create merit by making offerings, by prostrating, by requesting to teach and offering the Dharma wheel, requesting the Buddhas not to go into parinirvana, and offering the double dorje. Which, by the way, traditionally on the teacher's table, they put a double dorje in front. The Dharma, we gain merit with the Dharma by developing it in our mind stream through integrating it. And with the Sangha, we create merit by doing virtuous practices together with them, and also by making offerings to them and respecting them. Okay, so can you see the different functions that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha have in terms of our practice and in terms of how they help us, in terms of, you know, how we relate to them? So, you know, this is very good to reflect on, and then it gives us another way to think about the three jewels and how to relate to them. Yeah?
First of all, where is this list to be found? And I couldn't understand the first and the second, just the name of how you...
Okay, the first one was the characteristics, mm-hmm. and the second was the enlightening influence or awakening influence. And the list, I'm not sure what text it comes out of. I may have gotten it. Maybe it's in the Lamrim Chenmo, maybe not, but it, even if it's in the Lamrim Chenmo, it probably came out of another text in India. So check Lamrim Chenmo, see if you can find that. Okay, so then there's taking refuge through accepting the three jewels as ideals. Okay, so accepting the Buddha as the ideal teacher for taking refuge in, so the Buddha as the doctor, accepting the Dharma as the ideal refuge, as the medicine, accepting the... And so again, we keep coming back to the Dharma is the real refuge. Yeah? And that's really important to remember, you know, and to think about why is the Dharma the real refuge? The Dharma is not a living being. It's not a person. Why is it the real refuge? Because when we actualize the Dharma in our mind, then we are free of suffering. We are free of dukkha. Okay? So this is emphasizing that liberation comes from our own transformation, from our realizing the Dharma. It doesn't come through the Buddha protecting us, or the Guru protecting us, or the Sangha protecting us. Yeah? When we often call the Buddha a protector, but how does the Buddha protect us? Not by swooping down and carrying us away, you know, to heaven or something, but by teaching us the Dharma. That's how the Buddha protects us. But the real protection is the true paths and true cessations in our own mind stream. Okay, so His Holiness emphasizes this so much. He doesn't want people to be fixated on external people as their objects of refuge. Okay? But then the Sangha are the ideal friends for helping us to realize the refuge. So they're like the nurses. Okay? Or another way to put it is the Buddha is definitely what we'll attain, you know, what our aim is. The Dharma is definitely the method to attain it, and the Sangha will definitely help us do that. Okay. And then the next one is taking refuge by not speaking in favor of other refuges. Okay. So this is really encouraging us to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in a very pure way, without kind of indecisive wavering and doubt and, you know, kind of a lot of mental confusion, because there's so many different objects of refuge. I mean, in our ordinary life, our objects of refuge, you know, the credit card, the refrigerator, and the computer, the smartphone nowadays. I used to say the television. Now it's the smartphone. That's our three objects of refuge in America. Yeah? The smartphone, the refrigerator, and the credit card.
Yeah. Family, I would say it's family, the car, and traveling.
Traveling?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Germany, family,
car,
and traveling.
My perception.
Yeah. I was going to add a fourth one, which is the car in America.
It's pretty high up there. Mm-hmm. It's pretty high up there.
Yeah, it is.
Booze and relationships.
What'd you say? Booze?
Booze and relationships.
Yeah, booze and relationships are also high up there. Okay, so, you know, Lama Yeshe used to tell us, taking refuge is not something new to you, dear. You've been taking refuge your whole life. You've just been taking refuge in the wrong objects. Okay? But then there's different spiritual objects of refuge. Yeah, I mean, you can, there's a variety of religions. You can join any religion. You can go to any New Age thing. You can do any kind of spirit thing. There's so many different ways you can seek a spiritual path. Yeah, and so if we're not clear on what the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are, and why we're taking refuge in them, then we could very easily have some doubt. So doubt in terms of our ordinary refuges would be, we think, you know, Buddha's too high, Dharma's too difficult, Sangha also too advanced for me, so I can never attain this, so what's the use? Where's the smartphone, the credit card, the refrigerator, and how about some booze and drugs and relationship and family and car and traveling and whatever else I can get, you know? So a lot of people, you know, people start out in the Dharma and then sometimes they hit a point where it kind of, all this doubt comes up. You know, because the Dharma's really going in and they're seeing that, gee, the way I'm living my life is, something's wrong with what I'm doing and I need to change. But on the other hand, they don't want to change and they don't want to give up all the things that they think give them worldly pleasure. So then they have kind of a crisis. And, you know, what's my object of refuge? Is it the eight worldly concerns or is it the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? Yeah? Any of you been through that crisis?
Well,
yeah. You know? And then other times, you know, depending what religion we grow up in or, you know, what we hear from our friends, we may get really interested in, oh, you know, well, there's Kabbalah, and there's Sufi dancing, and there's crystals, and there's, you know, all these guys who are taking drugs and going on spiritual searches. Mm-hmm. Remember?
And shamanistic.
Shamanistic things. And you might remember that we're doing prayers for one family where the father did this. He was under the influence of drugs on one of these shamanistic journeys, and he injured his neck. Remember? It's a friend of somebody who comes here, and two young children, and he's in the hospital for months now, possibly a year. Yeah? So, you know, this kind of doubt in what your spiritual path is, then it's, you know, well, let's try everything and see what happens. This poor man really, he got very severely injured. Okay, so, you know, or depending if we were raised, we may have, you know, if you were raised with Christmas, you know, and all these childhood memories come with Christmas, and so Christmas season rolls around, and the magic of Christmas, and the togetherness of the family, you know, what the church looked like when you went in it, and this atmosphere of holiness and everything. So that may really come in your mind at Christmas time, and you may go, oh, you know, there was something really spiritual and holy about that. And, you know, believing in God out there, some kind of father figure who I can just surrender everything to, who controls everything, you know, that there's something so emotionally nice about that, isn't there? Big daddy who's gonna take care of you. Yeah. Except when there's God's will that we don't understand at all, but we forget about that. And just, you know, there's something very emotionally comfortable about it. So we can like to start going, oh yeah, that's good. Okay. So that may come up for people. Those are not my memories of Christmas time. My memories of Christmas time are being, you know, about the only, you know, one of maybe three kids in the school who didn't have Christmas trees and didn't have Christmas lights and didn't sing Christmas songs and, you know. So for me, Christmas was just like, yeah. And then everybody would come back and, oh, it was Christmas, it was wonderful, and Christmas dinner, and the church, and I'm gone. Anyway, that's, you know, my story. I got to tell you something about me in here. Okay. But for those of you, you know, that may come up. Feelings of looking at the statues of, you know, Mary and Jesus and all of this, emotional, yeah? So, yeah, so then, you know, maybe, our refuge starts to waver. So it's very important to be really quite clear in our refuge and, you know, the way to get clear is to really study and contemplate the teachings. And especially like when we talk about the four seals, you know, different points that make something the Dharma, to really go through those and think about them and develop some certainty in them. You know, and when you do, then you really have confidence that what the Buddha is teaching works and is correct. Okay, and then the next one is the benefits of taking refuge. Okay, so first we become a Buddhist. So some people like the name Buddhist and some people don't like the name Buddhist. It's quite interesting. You know, there's all these people who are closet Buddhists who go to a center for and retreat and they practice, but they don't want to tell their friends that they're Buddhist. They'll say, I go to a Buddhist center, or I'm reading a Buddhist book. But they won't say, I'm a Buddhist. And then you have other people who hardly understand anything about the Dharma, who go around proclaiming, I'm a Buddhist. So, having the name or not having the name, that's up to you, okay? But the point is, you know, if we sincerely take refuge, then, you know, we've established this very precious relationship with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we know what direction we're going in our spiritual practice. And we won't get sidetracked by going in other directions. Okay, second benefit of taking refuge, we establish the foundation for taking all further ethical restraints. Okay, so refuge confirms our motivation to be free of dukkha, and so that motivation sets the stage to want to take the different levels of precepts. Yeah, and so we start out with the different levels of the Pratimoksha precepts, the five precepts, or the monastic precepts, then Bodhisattva precepts, then Dhamma precepts. And if our refuge is strong, then we don't give up our precepts. Yeah, if people who don't have strong refuge, maybe they rush into things and take a lot of ethical restraints, and then their refuge isn't strong, and so then they begin to have doubts about, you know, why did I take all these sets of precepts anyway? Okay, so better to go slowly, increase your feeling of refuge, and then as you do so, slowly take more and more ethical restraints. Okay, but refuge sets the foundation for us to do that. Sometimes people ask me, can I take the five precepts without taking refuge? And it's an interesting question because I think where they're coming from is the five precepts are guidelines, basically, that you would find in all religions and even secular people. They're good secular, ethical, you know, guidelines. And so they're wanting to take those. They're not seeing them as something, quote, quote, religious, where you have to have refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to take them. Yeah? So that way, there's a certain reasoning to that that makes sense, isn't there? Okay, then the third benefit of taking refuge is we can eliminate the results of previously created negative karma. So by changing our outlook, by changing our actions, we develop new positive habits, and these override the old habits. Okay, so when we take refuge, we really begin the process of changing ourselves, transforming ourselves. Yeah, so it's not just, I take refuge in the Buddha, where's the beach? You know, I want to go sunbathe. It's I take refuge in the Buddha, and, you know, what can I do to approach the state of Buddhahood, or what can I do to get my life together? Or what is the Buddha's first kind of advice that he gives for me to practice? So, you know, which is ethical conduct. We start doing that, and then we really start the process of changing. Yeah. When you think about, you know, yourself on your Dharma path, how did you first start changing due to meeting the Dharma and becoming a Buddhist? Yeah.
Are you following the five precepts and just going with that?
Yeah, following the five precepts. Yeah. How about other people?
I stopped arguing with my mom.
Stop arguing with your mom. Yeah. Well, that has to do with ethical conduct, doesn't it? You know, abandoning harsh words.
Not harming so much.
Yeah, not harming others so much.
Identifying affliction.
Yeah, identifying afflictions, trying to subdue them so that we don't harm others, we don't harm ourselves.
Turn the mind inwards.
Turning the mind inwards to see what's going on in the mind.
Yeah,
so not getting distracted by frivolous things. Yeah.
Okay. Helping to cultivate joy and like really getting my good qualities a little bit of nourishment because they weren't really getting fed.
So for you, the first way you started changing was it nourished your good qualities.
Yeah. Huh?
Gave you some encouragement in your life. Okay. So it's interesting, you know, we read the list of the benefits, but then to say, well, how about for me? What was my own personal experience? You know, how did I initially benefit from taking refuge? Then, you know, as time went on, how did I benefit, like, after a couple of years, or after 5 years, or 10 years, or whatever? How did I benefit from having taken refuge? Okay, then the fourth one is we can quickly accumulate great positive karma because we follow the wise Dharma instructions. Okay, so the previous one was it helps us purify negativity and avoid creating more negative actions. And this one is it helps us to create great, you know, merit, great positive karma. Okay. Because we follow the wise instructions, and also because we start making offerings and bowing and thinking of the qualities of the Buddha, and that automatically creates merit in our mind and inspires us. Okay, and then the fifth benefit of taking refuge is we can't be harmed by humans and non-human beings. Yeah. So this one you have to think about, well, why? why would taking refuge in the Buddha protect me from being harmed by human beings?
You stop being a jerk. I mean, people will be less inclined to be incited into their own negative behaviors because we're restraining ourselves.
Yeah, so by taking refuge and starting to restrain ourselves, then we aren't as obnoxious. And so other people stop having reasons to want to hurt us or interfere with our happiness. Okay. And also, yeah, I mean, that's just something in this life, but also by practicing, we purify, we create merit. So in terms of karma, we don't have as much heavy karma that's going to ripen in the form of others harming us.
Also, our interpretation of harm changes.
Yes, imagine that. Also, our interpretation of harm changes. Yeah, because when we practice, we really start seeing all of our old mental habits and how we interpret, how we project harm where there is no harm. Yeah, and how, you know, before we get to a point in our Dharma practice where we can really begin to challenge the appearances, yeah, we are certain that how we see a situation is how it objectively exists. And we are certain we know somebody else's motivation. And that they're doing this action in relationship to me. And they're trying to get me. Yeah. And it isn't until we really start practicing the Dharma and the Lam Rim and the thought training that we begin to realize that this whole outlook that we have is seeing harm where there isn't harm. Yeah? And so by practicing, we begin to cease projecting negative motivations on other people and interpreting innocuous actions as something directed specifically against me. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
And also, even if there is harm, then we take it onto the path and it becomes something else.
Yeah. And when we do.
When we actually, rarely.
Yeah. When we are harmed, yeah, then we're able to transform it and, you know, make it part of the path. And see the good qualities of being harmed. Yeah, that whenever we're harmed, it's an opportunity to grow in a way that we would not have grown otherwise. Okay, then the sixth benefit of taking refuge is we won't fall to unfortunate rebirths. So this comes about through a few different ways. What do you? How do you think that one works?
Stop harming.
You stop harming, so you stop having the negative karma that will ripen in having a bad rebirth. What else?
Purify.
Yeah, we purify. Mm-hmm. What else?
Create a lot of merit.
Create a lot of merit. Yep. What else?
We transform our lives.
Yeah. There's another benefit I've said many times.
We stop creating the causes for it. But
but do you remember how I say that people listen to teachings, and then especially teachings about what to do about when they're dying, and then when somebody's dying, they completely blank out on what to do?
Oh,
so at the time of death, if you take refuge, your mind is in a virtuous state, And that's going to prevent any negative karma from ripening and throwing you into a lower rebirth. Okay, will we remember to take refuge at the time we die?
We certainly hope so.
We certainly practice to.
Yeah, but this is how you can be a real friend to somebody who's dying, is to give them that kind of advice. Okay. Then the seventh benefit is, in general, our virtuous purposes will be fulfilled, as well as our temporal goals. Okay, so by relying on a guide who knows how to create the causes for both our temporal and our ultimate goals, we'll be able to create those causes and attain our goals. So here, there's something from what Drum Dompa said. Drum was Atisha's close disciple. He was a lay practitioner. And he said, have hope and trust in the three jewels, not in sentient beings. Yeah. So make the three jewels your best friends. Yeah. Rely on the three jewels, and don't expect things from sentient beings that they have no ability to fulfill. Okay. So, you know, this whole thing of making offerings, requests, and so on before we undertake an activity helps us get our mind aligned with the Dharma and helps us to actualize our goal. And, you know, and then when we're acting to go towards our goal, we're actively trying not to have unrealistic expectations that come from taking refuge in ordinary sentient beings. Yeah? Because we expect ordinary sentient beings never to make mistakes, never to change their mind, always to fulfill their promise, always to be courteous, yeah? Always to be nice to us. But they're ordinary sentient beings, and things don't always work out according to our expectations. So, but if we place our trust in the three jewels, then we don't go down that slippery slope. And then the eighth benefit of taking refuge is we'll quickly attain Buddhahood by taking the essence of our precious human life. So that's kind of self-explanatory. And then the last outline is the guidelines for taking refuge. But we've gone through those before, so, and they're in the blue book, so good to read them again and refresh your mind. Now, I remember last time I went through them, people were really surprised. It's kind of like, you know, if you took refuge a long time ago and you're not, you know, twice a month going through and reading, you know, the verse or the whole thing in Pearl of Wisdom and looking over your refuge guidelines, then you forget you have them. Then you have the teachings on the guidelines for keeping refuge pure and you go, oh, gee, was I supposed to be doing that? So, good to review those. Okay, any questions or comments? Yeah.
I think the most important thing that I came to understand is that it's very much a long-term relationship, a long-term intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. And that the three jewels from their side are totally involved, and it's all about where I am, how far, how close have I been able to come to them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really, really, it's intimate.
Yeah.
It's really close, but it hasn't been like that. I mean, it's just starting to feel a little bit closer after many years.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a relationship that grows as long as I continue to practice and do my best. That I stopped seeing. One of the things that happened when I was thinking about the Buddha's qualities this week is that they're so magnificent that for so many years I had him so far away because I couldn't see him really wanting to have anything to do with me. You know, your whole thing about how does the Buddha look at you so kindly? And then I thought, you know, for the level of ignorance that I have and the level of afflictions and the incredible karma that I have on my mind stream that hasn't ripened yet, I would need a very magnificent, incredible guide to be able to get me through this. Mm-hmm. That I actually, all of his qualities are well suited for the place that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be somebody of that magnitude of the qualities to really help me. Because I'm really lost. I mean, I'm in there.
Yeah. Okay.
So it made it easier for me to see the qualities as something that would benefit me rather than something that pushes me away and keeps me down here.
Okay.
And him far away.
Yeah. So this is a very good example of what we were talking about, of seeing harm where there isn't harm, or seeing distance where there isn't.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, you know, of taking refuge, the Buddha was so way up there with all these magnificent qualities that why would he have anything to do with somebody like you? You know, and you kept the Buddha at, you know, more than arm's length. And then as you gradually began to practice and the whole way that you saw yourself began to change, then you realize that you need somebody with the magnificent qualities of a fully awakened one who is actually able to help you, and you began to open up to receive that help that the Buddha was giving.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that made a big change, and you began to see, like you said, it's a long-term intimate relationship. But from the Buddha's side, the Buddha's always steady in his side of the relationship. And we're like up and down, up and down, and in and out. You know. But it's always there when we want to really create that relationship with the three jewels.
And I started to understand causal refuge. That because of this change in relationship, I was actually creating the causes for the whole thing about one lifetime becoming the refuge myself, the whole Dharma in my mind, to see that this relationship has to do with me understanding what causal refuge meant, to have the result of the refuge sometime in the future. I've got to be able to invest in this relationship now.
Right.
To create the causes.
Yeah.
And it's all about being in relationship to this one. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where I put the Buddha. He's coming more closer in here. He's not so far out there. He's a little bit more inside.
Yeah. So to take refuge in the external three jewels so you can become the internal three jewels. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Gurana Mandalakam Niryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good hands in Gyatso Chen mercy. May you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Flow.